Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. There is news this week of a remarkable deal in the state of Maine. An unusual union of government, environmentalists, Indians, and a power company that may herald the return of the endangered Atlantic salmon. According to the deal, this environmental coalition has agreed to buy three dams on the Penobscot River, paying the power company some $25 million. This will free up hundreds of miles of the Penobscot River and allow the salmon to swim and spawn much more widely. Now, if fish could cheer, the sound of applause from the Penobscot would still be rather muted. Scientists estimate there are perhaps 1,000 Atlantic salmon left in that river. That's it. 1,000. In the 19th century, there were millions of fish. Indians in the Penobscot Nation talk of a salmon spawning run so thick you could walk across the river. Connection listeners, this hour we'll talk about this agreement and the compromises made by all sides in order to get there. These are compromises that will see public money used to purchase the offending power dams, to have two of them knocked down, and to allow other dams to be refurbished without opposition. And so how far can corporate executives and environmental activists go to settle this stuff out of court? What's lost and what is gained when environmental solutions are tailored to satisfy commercial interests? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us today from the NPR studios in Bangor, Maine, we have Scott Hall. He's manager of environmental services for the power company, PPL Maine. Laura Rose Day is a lawyer working as project director for the environmental groups of the Penobscot River Restoration Project. And John Banks is with the Penobscot Indian Nation. He's their director of the Department of Natural Resources. All together now, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Dick.
Scott, let me start with you. From your seat with the power company, I gather this was largely your idea. Where did you get the notion?
Well, I certainly don't want to take all the credit. We have a team of folks in the Maine office located in Milford, Maine, that manages the assets in the state of Maine for PPL. And we had gotten to a point where we realized when PPL first took over purchased the assets on the Penobscot River, that we needed and wanted to do business in a different way. We had a set of values that we wanted to, that were completely in line with PPL's values, and we wanted to try to do business in a productive way instead of an antagonistic way. And as a result, we decided that we wanted to sit down with all the folks that we've dealt with in the past and try to, start the dialogue and ideally, with persistence, come to a conclusion that everybody could be happy with.
And that's about 4 years ago you started with this. Is that right?
Yeah, about 4 years ago. It was May of 1999 when PPL Corporation purchased these hydroelectric assets. And myself and Dick Fenley, our manager for generating assets, first started the discussions in, I believe, October of 99.
And I wonder if it wasn't difficult to get some people in the boardroom to just buy into the notion of negotiating this. This is a long, long history. You know it well from lots of experience yourself in the past. Long history of litigation solving these issues. Were there some people in the boardroom going, "You're never going to settle this around a bargaining table"?
Not really. I think the difference was, again, that the culture, if you will, at PPL was much more of the notion being that we really ought to move forward. We ought to do everything we can to try to be productive. And the buzzword that we used was a productive use of capital. And there was a clear recognition that the courtroom wasn't the most productive use of that of those resources.
Laura Rose Day, let me bring you in here because as a lawyer working on environmental issues, you've been in this business for some time and you've seen a lot of ill will and antagonism, I bet.
I've seen some, yes, I'd say. And the approach here was a welcome one. That's not to say that from the beginning or even now all the parties agree on everything you might ask us about the future of this river, but we found a lot of common ground. We found a way to productively channel energy and resources of all of the organizations and the Penobscot Indian Nation and the company to come to a solution that we think will work very well for the future of this river.
In a nutshell, Laura, I described at the beginning of the program that the Environmental Coalition purchases three dams, takes two of them, or will then arrange to have two of them knocked down. Is there anything that's sort of in the headline of this deal that we also need to know about how it works?
Well, I think that you've got it. You've got the basics just right, Dick. The three dams will be purchased. Two of those dams are the most seaward dams, so those
closest
are the dams
to the ocean,
that,
yeah.
Closest to the ocean, that's right. And so those are the dams that that salmon, shad, striped bass, alewives, all the fish that have migrated up this river and between the river and the sea. Those are the first dams that they come to. And it's important to recognize that the issue here is that the way the dams are currently configured, fish have to go through multiple dam passages, three dams, four dams, to get to really prime spawning habitat. So what this project allows us to do, and I think this is really the concept that we'd like people to understand, is that it reconfigures PPL Corporation's assets. So from their perspective, the power generation will come from other places on the river, and it reconfigures basically it opens up a channel for the fish to go right upriver to their spawning habitat. They haven't reached it for quite a long time in an unimpeded fashion, and that's something that we expect to bring huge benefits to the sea-run fishery in the Penobscot.
John Banks, let me hear from you. You're director of the Department of Natural Resources for the Penobscot Indian Nation. Just how bad are things for the Atlantic salmon right now?
Well, they're pretty bad. I mean, this year we had just over 1,000 adult fish come back into the river system, which is a little bit higher in numbers than previous years. But there has been a steady decline in the numbers of Atlantic salmon returning to the Penobscot River.
Do you have real expectations that by taking down two of these dams that can be turned around?
Well, we do. And we believe that repairing the ecology of the river from the bottom up is really the way to go by establishing the historic connection between the Atlantic Ocean and the freshwater system of the Penobscot River by rebuilding the entire riverine ecology. The Atlantic salmon, along with the other species of fish that this project intends to restore, will be a huge benefit.
John, are you old enough to remember when there were more salmon in the river, or do we really have to go back to the 1800s?
Well, I'm not quite that old. But certainly, you know, within the tribe, there are memories that are passed down from generation to generation about those days when tribal members could gather thousands of salmon during the spring migrations.
I want to talk a little bit about how this is a change in the way of doing business. And John Banks, maybe you're the best person to start us off on this. Although talks have been going on for the past 4 years, I understand that, you know, for 20 years, Indians, environmentalists, people managing the power dams have actually been arguing over what to do with the Penobscot River.
Yeah, many of the dams have been in various stages of being relicensed through the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And when we're trying to restore fisheries and we're trying to address impacts from hydroelectric dams, we usually only have one chance in a lifetime to make some real differences because the licenses issued by the federal government are quite long. They're usually 30 or 40 or sometimes 50-year licenses. So we see this as a real once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to get some real benefits to the river.
And Scott Hall, what kind of a model is the arrangement that you've worked out? I mean, you've seen this you've worked with government regulating agencies and worked on different sides of this, haven't you?
Yeah, I think the model is really a matter of individuals being willing to sit down and not just say that they're trying to understand each other's issues, but really making a concerted effort to do so. I think one of the biggest things that that people could take from this is we came in early on in the discussions and made it very clear that we had some very specific business issues. We are a business, and while we have the values of trying to do the thing, do the right things at the right time, we have business concerns as well. We have, shareholders and the like. And one of the things that I think a lot of folks deserve credit for is understanding that and being able to, as Laura suggested, reconfiguring the river allows us to address our business concerns, address our responsibilities in an environmental fashion. But, that couldn't have happened unless people were really willing to sit down and understand those concerns. And we try to do the same thing on the other side.
Laura, go ahead, Laura.
I'm sorry. Well, I just wanted to share a similar perspective that we had. From the conservation organization's perspective, it's our job to look after the public trust in this river. And so we also explained our responsibility and our interests to the company, and I'd say that was the same all the way around the table, the state government, the federal government, the tribe, the conservation groups, and the company. And we were able to listen to each other's good ideas and come out with a solution that included some of all of those and not everything for anyone.
Yeah, and I think that's the important point, too, is the first step is trying to have a real understanding. Again, as Laura suggested earlier, there clearly are instances in the past and today and will continue to be in the future where people don't necessarily agree with each other, but we understand it. And that's a big, big difference from, I think, in the past where we really make that concerted effort. And perseverance was a big part of it. That's why it took 4 years.
But, Laura, $25 million, perhaps as much as $50 million to purchase and then remove the dams. That's a lot of money to ask people to commit to something like this. That's an unusual part.
It is. And we expect that funding to come from diverse sources, from private individuals and business, from state and federal conservation grant programs. And, the investments that are made, fisheries are an extremely valuable asset, and not just fisheries, but the other values of a free-flowing river. Aside from the spiritual and recreational aspects of rivers, there are a lot of businesses that can thrive on a river that has a fishery that's thriving, that has rapids, and there are opportunities for kayaking. Old Town Canoe is a business in Old Town, Maine, that will be sort of up at the top of the new free-flowing river. And it is an investment. There's no question about it. We think it's an investment that's worth making. We think it's an investment for the ecological gain in this project. The ecological gain really, we believe, far outweighs the gains from other investments that have been made in fisheries restoration. So, yes, it is a significant amount of money, but not too much for the benefits.
Connection listeners, a fascinating adjustment of the blinders here when the corporate executives start to look at the other interests and the conservation people and the Indians as well widen out to see what the other interests are in a river situation like this. How far can corporate executives and environmental activists go to settle these types of issues out of court? Is this deal on the Penobscot River a model for other issues across the country? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Some good news for the Atlantic salmon, at least those that who had ancestors that used to spawn in the Penobscot River. A deal announced this week between a coalition of environmental groups, the Penobscot Indian Nation, the PPL Power Company, that will see the removal of two dams at the lower end of the Penobscot River and free up a lot more of the water for return and spawning of the salmon and also many other species. We'll talk a little bit more about that. But Connection listeners, we're trying to figure out what's lost, what's gained when these types of solutions are worked out in a way that match the commercial interests and whether or not that's not the way things ought to operate. Are there times when the courts definitely need to be involved. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Let me go back, if I can, to Scott Hall, Manager of Environmental Services for PPL Maine, because, Scott, you talked about what the advantages are from the perspective of the Power Corporation. But in helping us understand just how novel this arrangement is, what do you see the other side as having given up here?
Again, from my perspective, I think it's not necessarily what they gave up. It's where they and we moved to. It's an understanding that there are resources and at times competing resources that everybody understands. And one of the things that struck me, I think, as we worked through this was the clear common goal of replacing any energy, you know, clean, renewable hydropower energy that would be lost associated with removing a dam. And the interesting dynamic was the veracity with which all the parties pursued that and really worked hard to do everything we could to find a way to replace the energy. And again, that satisfies PPL's business concerns. But it's also what I believe to be the responsible thing to do, given our energy circumstances, you know, in the state of Maine and elsewhere.
Okay, but let's assume for the sake of the conversation that a corporate executive with another power company hears about this and calls you up and says, okay, Scott, I get it. I get the idea of staying out of court, not going into these protracted battles over the relicensing of dams. That would be great. But how would we convince the conservation groups in our part of the country that this is a good deal for them? And so much of this is about the enemy. You know, the environmentalists see the corporations as the enemy, and the corporations see these tree huggers as the enemy. How do you make the case that it's a good deal for the people on the other side of the table? How would you advise a colleague on that?
Well, I think the reason it took 4 years is because we probably spent the first 2 years gaining some common understanding. And I think at one point we were talking earlier, and John probably put it best, that everybody kept their eye on the ball, and the ball was the end goal. And there was a lot of work in between, and that combined with you know, everybody understanding what their interests were, and as Laura suggested, her interest was to provide a better opportunity for restoration of a number of different fish species. So, you know, from my perspective, I think that it is a lot of work and a lot of time and effort to get to that common understanding because of the fact that a lot of people start on opposite sides of the pole.
Mm-hmm. And Laura, how would you make the case to a colleague that a deal like this can work?
Well, I think in all these cases, it depends on the circumstances. You know, when you talk about whether this is a model for other places, the solution for every river is different, and it's suited to not only the companies that impact the river, but the particular uses of the river and what the opportunities and of the legal system and what the opportunities of a compromise solution are. And, you know, in this case, we had one company that owned all of the assets on the lower river. We have a river that historically had a tremendous fishery and many traditions, such as, you know, in Maine is the home of the oldest salmon angling club in the nation. And one cannot fish for salmon in this state any longer. There were a lot of different opportunities to recover here, having to do with the fishery and having to do with the free-flowing river. You know, one of the interesting traditions in Maine was the catching and giving of the first caught salmon of the season to the President of the United States. The last president to receive that salmon was President Bush.
Bush won.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is a tremendous loss, the cultural loss to the Penobscot Indian Nation and to just the people who live along the river. And I guess that if you can take with everyone's interests in mind, if you can take the best ideas that people can bring to a solution, if you can get people in a room who will try to contribute to not only getting what they need in the deal, but also keeping in mind and truly trying to work for what others need in the deal too, you can go a long way. You can't do it in all situations. There's no question about it. But we found that we could do it here.
And John Banks, the other aspect that seems to have been successful here, as I'm listening to Laura and Scott describe their perspectives, is that people started to look at what the local interests were, the local interests of the businesses, the local interests of the Penobscot Nation were, of course, foremost here. But that keeping the conversation local made it something that everybody could understand.
Sure. Yeah, you know, there's an old saying about not being critical of another person's ideas until you've walked a mile in their moccasins. And I think, as Scott and Laura both said, the first 2 years of these negotiations really focused on trying to fully understand each and everybody's interests and issues and desires with respect to their particular use of this magnificent river. And I think that's really what has made this project come to the status that it is now, and that we've been able to reach this mutual agreement.
And Dick, this is Scott, and I think you're exactly right in the sense that we did make a concerted effort to try to make the decisions, here, as opposed to sending them, for example, to Washington to be made. Everybody understood that we could very well send them to Washington and allow somebody else to make decisions that we would then have to live with. And we did try to take into account what we understood to be issues of other folks in the communities, for example. From my perspective, one of the things that has always struck me over the last 4 years, particularly with PPL Corporation, is again the influence that they feel is important to have in communities. Here in the Bangor area, we made a significant contribution to a children's museum, and it's easy to say, well, money talks, but the concerted effort by the corporation that we, the folks here in Maine, see, that work here in Maine, see of encouraging us to be part of the community.
But you live there too.
I absolutely
right? You live in Orono.
I absolutely do. And that
are you a fisherman?
You bet. I spend as much time as probably anybody, with the exception of John's fishery biologist, fishing for smallmouth bass on the river, and that's why. In terms of my personal values, they're in line with what the company promotes. And as a result, that did make it easier to continue to have the discussions. But ultimately, it allowed us to make our decisions here and make those so that we all knew what we were going to live with in the future, as opposed to sending it down to somebody when you don't really know what the end result's going to be.
Right, we've got a lot of people who want to get in here. So let's go first to Courtney, who's calling in from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Courtney.
Hi, Dick. How are you? Great topic this morning. I'd like to reframe the topic a little bit, the discussion a little bit in terms of you were talking about corporate versus environmentalists. I think this whole topic really speaks to the issue of environmentalists versus environmentalists. We've seen this in the Cape Wind controversy, where we have the scenic environmentalists, which I characterize as the scenic environmentalists who want to preserve everything to make it look nice, and then environmentalists who are concerned about global climate change.
Well, where do you put the environmentalists who are trying to bring back salmon? I mean, that's not just about
pretty
rivers. Well,
here's the issue. Here's the issue, Dick, is that the water itself is going to be – these fish are going to be fried alive if we don't deal with the issue of climate change. Look at the Danube River and the Rhine, which was just on National Public Radio this morning. They're half the level they used to be. Now, this speaks to two issues. One, global climate change, also the fact that hydropower may be doomed in the long term. That's in fact true. But my concern is this. If we're taking away renewable energy, where are we replacing it? I'm all for dealing with the fisheries.
Right.
Let's do that. But if you guys want to take if these environmentalists, this side of the environmental movement, wants to take out dams, I ask that you help us to pay for renewable energy. Put it in place now. Buy it first. buy the renewable energy now, put it in place before you tear the dam down. Because think of it, if we take this renewable energy out...
Let me just tell you one feature of the arrangement that perhaps hasn't been as carefully explained, Courtney, and that is that one part of this arrangement is one feature of the arrangement allows PPL to expand its power generating capability in its other six dams on the Penobscot. So really there's about a 10% loss of generating capacity. Nothing quite as dramatic as it might sound by the removal of three dams. But I think your point's a good one for Laura to speak to about, you know, these competing interests that exist not just in the way that I framed them earlier, but between different environmental groups. Laura?
I think it is a great point, Courtney, and you know, Dick is right that one of the things that we worked pretty hard at in this agreement was the potential for replacing generation on the river. And you know, obviously, even though it sounds like you're very focused on global climate change, you know, the organizations I represent are not monolithic. Maine Audubon is particularly interested in the project because of the recovery of habitat for waterfowl and macroinvertebrates that feed all kinds of songbirds. Their Trout Unlimited and Atlantic Salmon Federation are interested, primarily the cold water fisheries, including Atlantic salmon. The Natural Resources Council of Maine is an organization that works on all kinds of policy issues in the state of Maine, including energy. So, you know, I think that to cast the entire discussion in terms of us against them, it's not quite that clear. One power company is not the same as the next, nor is one environmental organization the same as the next. You know, the recovery of the Penobscot River involves a great number of factors, but there's widespread agreement that allowing fish access to historic habitat of the magnitude that this project will be, you know, perhaps the single most significant step to their recovery. And that's not to say that there aren't lots of other environmental issues that we all ought to continue to work on, including energy.
Courtney, I wonder if I can ask you a question here, because looking at it from the perspective where you see it, if you got a letter from the Penobscot River Restoration Project saying this is what we've done, would you be interested in making a contribution to make this work? What would you think?
I just see it as a national issue. I mean, I see the Snake River Dam.
I know you're chickening out here. What would you do if Laura sent you a letter saying, hey, send $25 to make this happen?
We need more renewable energy, not less. And I think that these fish are going to be fried alive by what's happening in climate change right now. Unless we get more renewable energy going, all I'm saying is that environmentalists, groups of us, are in total denial, and that we're basically, you know, just doing little gestures here and there. But the real issue, like the Danube at half the level, the Rhine down to half the level, Europe on fire last summer.
Okay, Courtney, I'm going to take your answer as a no and try and stay with this topic of the Penobscot. Thank you for calling in 1-800-423-8255 to High Point, North Carolina now, and Marcus is with us. Hi, Marcus.
Good morning, and thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
My comment is that I think this model goes far beyond environmentalists and power companies. This is a model for many states and organizations who start out in conflict with each other, moving beyond the conflict and moving to a non-adversarial place where they can see a win-win for each side. And I think that's what's happened here. And I think both the power company and the environmentalists are to be commended for moving beyond the adversary and moving to a place where they can say, yeah, we can get something from this and you can get something from this.
I'd like to hear from John Banks on this. John, I didn't ask you at the beginning of the program. I'm curious to know how difficult it was for you to persuade elders or others in the Penobscot Nation that giving up some land, the sacrifices that the Penobscot Nation had to make were worth it for this.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of discussion within the tribe about a lot of controversial issues, and there's many heated discussions that go on about things. But when it comes to discussions about restoring the ecological health of the Penobscot River, they usually come together fairly quickly. And in this case, in dealing with some of the impacts to the reservation, PP&L was, quite cooperative in working with the tribe to make sure that each and every one of the impacts are properly addressed to the tribe's satisfaction.
So picking up what Scott said earlier, keeping the eye on the ball, the eye on the river, the eye on the fish was the way to make it happen?
Exactly.
And Laura, just back to what Marcus was saying from High Point, do you see it as a model, as a perhaps a model of principle, if not a model of detail, that other conservation organizations and power companies or corporations should be looking at?
Well, I do think it's a model of principle, because I don't think that we can afford in this day and age, with the complicated problems that Courtney points out, to disregard good ideas and solutions because they come from someone who has a different principal goal than our own. That isn't to say that this model will solve all problems. I don't think it will. The reality is that there are a lot of situations where, there isn't a solution that people can come to that involves a lot of common ground. And that's the reason that we have good laws and a legal system and administrative law systems in this country. And, I have certainly been involved in situations where, those systems worked quite well. In Maine, in 1999, the Edwards Dam was removed on the Kennebec River. That was a dam that was ordered removed by FERC. In that situation, that was the process that led to that solution, and we've seen a great recovery on that river. On the Penobscot River, in this situation with this company, we were able to come up with something different, and I think that we will all benefit, the state of Maine, all of the parties that are involved here, from having found it.
Connection listeners, different solutions to different problems, coming at it from a local point of view and looking at a way of negotiating solutions to environmental difficulties like this one. 1-800-423-8255. Do you see more of this coming in the future? When we come back after the break, we'll talk a little bit more about the Edwards Dam, because it does stand as something of an example and a guide for the people who looked at the latest deal that we're discussing on the Penobscot River. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our ancestors, our former presidents, people like Teddy Roosevelt, told us that the waters and the land of this country were a public resource. And what we're talking about on the program today is the idea, the notion, a new one, relatively new one, of paying money to make sure that that resource stays in public hands. Do you think that's an appropriate call for environmentalists, conservation groups to make? Can you argue with them that, hey, we own that already, we shouldn't have to pay for it? What's your view on the deal that's been struck to try and bring the salmon back to the Penobscot River? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. With me on the program, John Banks. He's Director of Natural Resources for the Penobscot Indian Nation. Scott Hall heads up Environmental Services for PPL Maine. That's the power company that currently owns the dams. And Laura Rose Day is Project Director for the Conservation Groups of the Penobscot River Restoration Project. And Laura, let's just go back and finish that little bit about the Edwards Dam on the Kennebec River, which was, I think it was blown up in 99. Isn't that right?
Not quite blown up, but it was removed. It was removed by first taking out a small section of the dam and putting in an earthen cofferdam, and then gradually the entire structure was removed from the river. Okay. And that dam was located, that was also the dam closest to the ocean. And there has been the beginning of a great recovery on the Kennebec River. There are
almost more than people expected.
Yes, I think much more than many people expected. I have talked to many folks who have lived on the Kennebec for a long time, and the river was without fish above Augusta, Maine for so many years that it was quite frankly hard for many people to imagine fisheries rebounding there. There was a bass fishery, and there still is. But now, in addition to that, there are American shad, striped bass. There are shad reproducing up and down the entire stretch that was opened above the river. There are sturgeon above the river. And, so I've been at the top of the 18 miles of newly free-flowing river with children who were fishing, and they can see sturgeon leaping out in the river now. That hadn't happened for more than 170 years. So, yes, I would say it's been successful, and I think that it shows much promise for the Penobscot River.
Connection listeners, just a couple of notes for you. You might remember when John McPhee was on the program talking about his new book, The Founding Fish, The Return of the American Shad. He talked about witnessing the tearing down of the Edwards Dam on the Kennebec River. There's a beautiful description of that event if you're interested in looking it up on The Founding Fish. And speaking of looking things up, you might want to check our website. We're at theconnection.org, and what you can see there on the website, compliments of our guests today, are photographs of the dams that are being taken down, photographs of some of the other dams that are not being taken down. But what they show you, perhaps better than some imagined notion of what the Hoover Dam might look like, is precisely how these dams stretch across the river and give you an idea of what might change when they're finally removed. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's take our next call from Charleston, South Carolina. Scott's joining us now. Hi, Scott.
Hello. How are you doing this morning?
Fine. Thank you for calling.
I called in because what you're discussing here really resonates with parallel experiences that we have had in the forest industry and environmental issues. And I think that the group that you have here are really projecting a model that has to be used going forward, the one of collaboration, the one of mutual understanding, and the common search for solutions.
How does it work in the forest industry, Scott? What's a parallel example that you would give us?
Well, I think that there is no area in which there has been greater contention among environmental and other interests than questions about forest and harvesting and management and use. I co-lead with a colleague from the Nature Conservancy an international organization called the Forest Dialogue that's based at Yale University and promotes collaboration among the environmental, private landowner, and industry communities. It's taken us 3 years to build the mutual trust and respect and understanding among people from diverse organizations, where people get beyond seeing titles and roles and get down to flesh and blood reality of mutual interest. But once you get there, it's amazing what you can accomplish together.
You need a lot of patience, though. That's a long wait.
Well, that was one of the points that was brought out in your discussion this morning among those there who are there with you, the length of time that it took, the persistence that it took, and frankly, I don't think there's any other way.
Yeah, Scott Hall was talking about that. And Scott, I wonder if I can, Scott in Charleston is talking about the forest industry and we're talking about salmon in Maine, just make note of the fact that the new soon-to-be head of the EPA, Mike Leavitt, former Utah governor, is a person who talks a lot about trying to find solutions to environmental difficulties, precisely the way that you've done it in Maine and Scott's working at from South Carolina. Do you think, as I was asking Laura earlier, that there are principles here that need to be carefully looked at and maybe used more often?
I absolutely do, and I agree with Scott. The key is to start out. You have to develop a mutual trust, and that starts with some respect for individuals. He mentioned that there are one of the important things is we're all people and we all live here, and having the ability to disagree with somebody but still respect that they have the right for their own opinion. And again, I go back to one of the examples that I gave earlier. In terms of, and this actually speaks to a point Courtney made earlier as well, about energy replacement. We actually have the opportunity through this agreement to increase our generation in the short term. We'll actually have more generation from renewable hydropower over the first few years with this agreement than we have today. And as a result, we also have the opportunity to replace up to 90% of the energy that would be lost. And that didn't happen immediately. That only happened when there was a mutual trust for us to be able to exchange information and believe that the information we were sharing with each other is forthright. And again, from the company's perspective, you know, we were certainly encouraged to be, you know, honest and have integrity and you know, the things that most people are very much in tune with, and it was really something that you know, the support of the company to be able to allow us to share in a fashion that built that trust and respect, I think over time, and it wasn't easy and it took a lot of time, that got us to the point where we are today.
Laura Rose Day, I wonder if, though, there's a part of you that's thinking, you know, this is only going to go so far. You used to work for the EPA. You will know that, you know, litigation or the threat of litigation can be something that gets people's attention. Is that always going to be a part of resolving these types of issues?
I think to some extent it will always be part of it, because one of the things that drives all of the parties to this agreement is that there is a legal system that governs the use of this river. And while at some facilities, the company now, including the one at the head of the river, the company has a license. It's under appeal, but there are various licenses in various stages, and there is a lot of uncertainty related to every single one of them. There are rules for the use of our rivers. The rivers do belong to the public. By the same token, there are rights for companies to use rivers under certain conditions. So, you know, yes, the rules are important. And I think that the rules and having principled rules for using public resources kind of help set up the playing field, if you will.
So are we talking about some kind of a change in the conservation mindset, the idea of paying for those improvements?
Well, you know, the idea of paying for assets is not foreign to the conservation movement. I mean, there are certainly many, many land deals, for instance, recently even in Maine, that follow that model. I think one of the things that's innovative about this deal is that we're talking about aquatic restoration
right
here. You know, if you fly over the Penobscot watershed, you can point down and show someone the big, vast tract of green forest that they're going to preserve. Here, we're talking about life under the water, and it's a sort of I think it's sometimes more difficult for people to understand the public resource that's really missing right now here, and the promise of the fisheries for the future. You know, I think all of these things have a place in finding resolution.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go next to New Hartford, Connecticut, and Tom's joining us. Hi, Tom.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Seems like most companies just assume that their shareholders are one-dimensional and they're only interested in profit. Did you poll your shareholders, and do you see a way for shareholders to express environmental or, you know, other concerns?
I think that's a great question, Tom. Again, this is Scott. What we did, what this agreement allows us to do is not only satisfy our requirements in relation to shareholders, but it also allows us to satisfy our responsibilities in terms of the environment. And, you know, we absolutely believe, because we have, you know, written principles, environmental and corporate responsibility principles, that every shareholder that purchases a share of the company has the opportunity to understand what the company's core values are. And at the same time, we did have a responsibility and we did have business interests that we made crystal clear. And most everybody can rest assured that was a very important part of the discussion, and the recognition that we had those responsibilities to shareholders as well as our environmental or corporate responsibilities. The recognition of that was very, very important on behalf of the other parties. And when we get to that point, we were able to talk about solutions again, as opposed to continuing to disagree with each other over policy.
And Tom, your question seems to imply that, at least in your mind, there is among shareholders an appreciation or an understanding of both sides of the issue here that maybe the corporations haven't been paying as much attention to as they should have.
Yeah, I think it's really easy for managers to minimize their shareholders' interest down to profit, and I think shareholders are a lot more dimensional than that. And I don't think there's a mechanism for that to be expressed in our current financial situation, you know.
All right. I appreciate your call. Thanks for calling
Thanks.
In. Laura Rose Day, what happens if you don't raise the money?
Well, if we don't raise the money, then the parties will largely be back where they started. We'll have a system of, you know, a river system with several hydropower projects, and each of them will go through an individual license. There are, as I said earlier, kind of rules for the relicensing of those projects that have to do with fish passage requirements, and you know, we'll be back to where we started.
Which means going back to court, right?
Well, and not necessarily, Dick. I think it's important for folks to understand that the agreement actually outlines kind of a two-path map, if you will. One being if the funding is raised and the projects are purchased, and the other, speaking to making decisions here, we know where that other path takes us in the event that the option to purchase the projects is not exercised. We know largely what we're going to be faced with for our obligations related to licensing. And yes, there's a process, but certainly we're firmly convinced that the opportunity to sit down and talk with folks, those processes will not, even in the unlikely event that that were to happen, will not result in the same kind of a dynamic that has existed in the past.
Let me get the last word from John Banks. Is this going to happen, John? Is this deal going to go through?
Well, we certainly hope so. To the Penobscot Nation, this is by far the largest and most important conservation project that we've been involved with, and it really presents a real opportunity for tribal members to regain a portion of their culture that has been lost.
I want to thank all of you for being with us. John Banks, good to hear from you.
Thank you.
John Banks directs the Department of Natural Resources for the Penobscot Indian Nation. Scott Hall, thank you for your time.
We appreciate it, Dick.
Scott's manager of environmental services for PPK Maine, and Laura Rose Day, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Laura's project director for the conservation groups of the Penobscot River Restoration Project. Connection listeners, just a reminder, there are those photographs of the dams and the river that I mentioned on our website if you want to have a better idea of what these folks are dealing with. Our program is produced by Khalil Bird, Nancy Cohen, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Orit Karitsky-Fox, Jen Mattson, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.